Now let's learn some more about the Cantor set. This is really a remarkable set that people are still studying today. It's a remarkable source of various kinds of counterexamples. So in the last lecture, we showed that the Cantor set has zero length. So in some sense, the Cantor set is small. Now we will show that in another sense, the Cantor set is large. Proposition: the Cantor set is uncountable. We will assign a binary address to each element of the Cantor set in the following way. The address will be a sequence of zeros and ones. Fix an element x of the Cantor set. Examine the second figure in the last lesson. The first entry of the address is a zero if x is in the left component of I1. Otherwise, the first entry is a one. Now look at the third figure. An open segment is removed from the segment in the second figure in which x resides. Thus, x is either in the resulting left component or in the resulting right component. The result, the second address entry, is either a 0 or a 1. Continue in this fashion, assigning the jth address entry to be 0 or 1 according to whether x lies in either the left or the right component of the divided interval ij. We see that we may assign to each element of the Cantor set a sequence of zeros and ones. Conversely, each sequence of zeros and ones determines an element of the Cantor set using the same logic. We learned earlier in class that the set of all sequences of zeros and ones is uncountable, so the Cantor set is uncountable. We conclude this discussion by constructing a counterintuitive function called the Cantor-Lebesgue function. It has the property that is continuous, its derivative is zero at most points, that is, on the complement of the Cantor set, yet the function is not constant. A graph of the function is exhibited in the next figure. There exists a continuous function C with domain the interval 0, 1 closed, and range the interval 0, 1 closed such that number 1, the function takes the values 0 at 0 and 1 at 1. The function C is monotone increasing, and on the complement of the Cantor set, C is locally constant. Here's a picture of the graph of the Cantor-Lebesgue function. It doesn't, of course, it doesn't show you the whole graph, but it suggests how it works. Proof of the proposition. Define the Cantor-Lebesgue function in this way. C of x equals summation j equals 1 to infinity I sub j times 2 to the minus j to the power I sub j if x is in C and x has the address I sub j, the address being the sequence of zeros and ones. And if x is not in the Cantor set, define C of x to be the sup of C of t, where t is in the Cantor set and t is less than or equal to x. Here, sup is the abbreviation for supremum, which is the same thing as least upper bound. In the first line of the definition on the right, we use the address, the sequence of zeros and ones, that was our device for seeing that the Cantor set is uncountable. Notice that we first define the Cantor-Lebesgue function for x in the Cantor set, and then we define the function at points not in the Cantor set in terms of our earlier definition at points of the Cantor set. This definition is rather technical, but we could also give a heuristic description of how the Cantor-Lebesgue function is constructed. On the single interval that is removed in the construction of I1, we declare the Cantor-Lebesgue function to have value 1/2. On the pair of intervals removed in the construction of I2, we declare the Cantor-Lebesgue function to have value 1/4 on the left and 3/4 on the right. On the four intervals removed in the construction of I3, we declare the Cantor-Lebesgue function to have values 1/8, 3/8, 5/8, and 7/8, and so on. The values of the Cantor-Lebesgue function at the intermediate points of the Cantor set are obtained by interpolation. It is clear from our rigorous definition of the Cantor-Lebesgue function that it is monotone increasing, for if x1 is less than x2 are elements of the Cantor set, then the address of x2 will have more ones in it than the address of x1. Hence, the sum defining the value of C will have more positive terms. Likewise, if x1 is less than x2, and these are not elements of the Cantor set, and have an element of the Cantor set between them, then the sup defining Cx2 will be a supremum over more numbers than the sup defining Cx1, and hence will be larger. If there are no elements of the Cantor set between x1 and x2, then by definition, C of x1 equals C of x2. The verification of monotonicity for one point in the Cantor set and one point not in the Cantor set is immediate from the definitions. The continuity of the Cantor-Lebesgue function follows from similar but more technical considerations. It's really a proper topic for a course in real analysis, which is more advanced than this course. Now we're going to turn to a more formal introduction to topology. So in mathematics and the physical sciences, it's important to be able to compare shapes or forms of objects. What do we mean by shape? What does it mean to say that an object has a hole in it? Is the hole in the center of a basketball the same as the hole in the center of a donut? That's an interesting question. One's intuition suggests that those are both holes, but they're different types of holes. Somehow, the hole in the center of a basketball is sort of a three-dimensional hole, and the hole in the center of a donut is more like a two-dimensional hole. It's more like the hole in the center of a circle. Is it correct to say that a ruler and a sheet of paper have the same shape because both are, after all, rectangles? What is the rigorous and mathematical means of establishing that two objects are equivalent from the point of view of shape or form? So that's what topology is about. So now let's launch into the subject of topology. A topological space is a set X together with a set of subsets. Capital script U equals the set of all capital U sub alpha that we call the open sets. We assume that A, the entire space X is open. In other words, X is equal to U alpha naught for some alpha naught. The empty set is open. In other words, the empty set is U alpha 1 for some alpha 1. If U sub beta are open sets, then their union is another open set. So in other words, open sets are closed under arbitrary unions. And if U and V are open sets, then U intersect V is an open set. So U is closed under pairwise intersection or in fact, finite intersection, but not under infinite intersection. The entire subject of topology is based on the idea that if you know the open sets of a space, then you know about its form. We sometimes write our topological space as the ordered pair capital Roman X comma capital script U. Example, let X be the real numbers. Let us declare every open interval A comma B to be an open set. And A is allowed to be minus infinity and B is allowed to be plus infinity. We also declare any union of such intervals to be an open set. And it's easy to see the collection U of all the open sets that we have described forms a topology. Of course, the empty set is the union of no open intervals. And the entire line is the union of all open intervals. The entire real line is an open set according to our definition. Typical open sets are U1 equals open interval minus 3, 5. U2 is open interval minus 1, 3, union open interval 4, 9, union open interval 16, 31. Another example is U3 is the union of minus 3, 2, open interval, union open interval minus 1, 0, union open interval 1, 2, union open interval 3, 4, and so on in both directions. And U4 finally equals the open interval minus infinity minus 5, union the open interval 7 plus infinity, is another open set. We call this topology the standard topology or the usual topology or the Euclidean topology on the real line. Example, let X be Euclidean N space. We use coordinates to denote a point X in capital X, namely X equals X comma X sub 1, X 2, through xn. Let us say that union is an open set if whatever x is in U, then there is an epsilon bigger than 0 so that the ball B x epsilon equals the set of all t and rn so that the distance between t and x is less than epsilon lies in U. We commonly refer to B x epsilon as the open ball with center x and radius epsilon. The entire space U equals rn is an open set according to this definition, and so is the empty set, but there are lots of other open sets as well. The set of all t equals t1 through tn and rn, so that absolute tj less than 1 for j equal 1 through n, is easily checked to be an open set. For if x equals x1 through xn is in t, then epsilon equals the minimum of absolute value xj plus minus 1. With that epsilon, the ball with center x and radius epsilon lies in t as required. The figure illustrates this idea. The open sets are closed under the union operation and under finite intersection. So Rn, equipped with the notion of openness specified above, is a topological space. We call this topology the standard topology or the usual topology or the Euclidean topology on Rn. It's worth noting that the topology described here is generated by all the balls Bx epsilon. Each such ball is open, just as the example set T above was open. Second, a union of such balls is clearly open. Third, if U is any open set according to our definition of the first paragraph, then each point in U has a ball about it that lies in U. So U is a union of open balls. Thus, the collection of open balls is just the same as the collection. The collection of unions of open balls is just the same as the collection of open sets. It is worth observing explicitly that the topology described here in case the dimension n is 1 is just the same as the topology that we described earlier. remark. For the record, we note that the closed ball with center x and radius epsilon Euclidean space is given by b over bar x epsilon equals the set of all t in Rn, so that absolute t minus x is less than or equal to epsilon. The figure illustrates what a closed ball looks like. Example, let x be the unit interval 0, 1. Let the only open sets be the empty set and the entire interval. One may check directly that all the axioms for a topological space are satisfied. In particular, the union of the specified open sets can only be the empty set of the entire space. The same can be said for the intersection. And that's it for today. Thank you for listening.